Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's Political Commentary.
Today on Political Commentary, we're just focusing on Roe v. Wade, the five-decade-long decision that guaranteed the right of women and people who can become pregnant to get an abortion. As the spokesperson for Abortion Law Reform Association of New Zealand and Abortion Rights Aotearoa, what was your first thought when you heard about Roe v. Wade being overturned?
I mean, to be honest, my first thought is probably not something that you can air on the radio. It was a sense of dismay, but not surprise. It was that inevitability that ever since it was settled in 1973, there's been these concerted efforts to chip away at its protection or to outright overturn it. And then, of course, we got the leak earlier in the year that kind of said it's on the way out. So it wasn't entirely surprising, but still really disappointing, because I think those of us in the realm of abortion rights are really aware of the consequences when there is not access to safe and legal abortion, people that are going to suffer real harm because of this decision.
How did we get here? You said that ever since it was decided in the 70s that people have been trying to fight against it, but what do you think some of the political and social changes perhaps in recent years have led up to this moment where something like this can happen?
We've seen it in the States is a series of these tracked laws, so these targeted regulations of abortion providers, or these incremental restrictions just to try and chip away at Roe versus Wade. So they're implementing these regulations or these state laws that they're hoping will become that case that gets appealed up to the Supreme Court that limits Roe versus Wade, which is what Dobbs and Jackson's Women's Health was about. It was an outright ban at 6 weeks. So you've seen that recently in the past kind of two decades, is things like requiring clinics to have admitting privileges to hospitals. Abortion is safer than getting your wisdom teeth taken out. You don't need to have admitting privileges to the local hospitals, but that's an onerous expense on abortion clinics. So fewer clinics can meet those requirements, fewer clinics can stay open, and fewer people can access care. So you've seen restrictions like that. In the past few years, what you've seen is these heartbeat laws, or 6 week bans, things like that. And I think that they're getting bolder because, you know, Trump was there. He appointed three Supreme Court justices. Trump ran on a pro-life, anti-choice, anti-abortion platform. That 2016 election was so consequential. I mean, three Supreme Court seats up for grabs. It's now a 6-3 conservative majority. It's changed the shape of the Supreme Court for decades, generations to come. In terms of the last 50 years, it's harder to be more specific with the breadth of the misogyny. But I mean, it's become a political talking point, and it's become a real flashpoint in Democratic and Republican politics over there for a while, for sure.
Moving into the future, what do you see the effects of this being politically, socially, in 5 years and in 10 years? Like, how much change do you think will occur?
I think, I mean, the immediate answer, which is people are going to die. So what's going to happen is people are going to need abortion care. They're not going to be able to access it. They're going to have health complications that mean they die. People who can get pregnant are at high risk of homicide from intimate partner violence when they're pregnant and cannot access care. You're going to have people that cannot access abortions in their state resorting to unsafe methods to end their pregnancy. You're going to have people who are having children that they do not want to have and that they cannot support. So that's kind of the immediate effects on people. I think on the state level, you're going to see we've got 13 states that had trigger laws in place, which meant as soon as Roe versus Wade was overturned, they snapped into action and abortion was immediately outlawed in that state, or severe restrictions were in place on abortion. Other state legislators, you're going to see the same thing. They're either going to be getting everyone back into session to pass an abortion ban really, really quickly, or, you know, a couple of states might have the opposite and they'll become state protections on abortion. You're going to have people that are going to be trying to travel across state lines to access care. You're going to have prosecutions for abortion care providers and for people seeking abortion care. I think broadly, more legally, I mean, Roe versus Wade was decided on the basis of the right to privacy, that the decision to have an abortion was between a woman and her healthcare provider, and that the state shouldn't have a say in that. That's the same sort of reasoning that's been applied for decisions like interracial relationships, gay marriage, access to contraception, all those kind of privacy-based rights, you're going to see cases that are going to be chipping away at that because conservative lobbyists and legislators know that there is a Supreme Court that's willing to uphold those decisions.
I'd love to talk a bit more on the social and economic effects of having children that you're not prepared to have and that you don't necessarily want.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the trends when abortion was decriminalized or legalized, time of women's real liberation. They could walk outside the home, they could control if and when they wanted to have families. It was fundamental to their economic liberation, which in turn leads to social liberation. Like it or not, people need to have money and wealth and resources to be able to function as independent people and not be reliant on husbands and things like that. Women having children that they don't want to have, that takes them out of the workforce. It makes them incredibly physically vulnerable. Pregnancy is not a health neutral event. It has really severe complications for the body, and it makes them vulnerable in terms of they have to rely on other people to for them and their child to be able to survive. So it puts women in a really, really vulnerable position. Mm. And I mean, incidentally, if they can raise that child that they don't want to have, because you see, statistics of increased crime rates, increased child poverty rates when people cannot support children that they don't want to have, is only going to increase that real social and financial vulnerability.
Well, I'd like to move now to Aotearoa and some of the political responses that we've seen. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern posted a statement condemning the decision to overturn Roe versus Wade, as has the Green Party. We've had Simon O'Connor from the National Party tweeting, celebrating the decision, which has since been taken down, and Christopher Luxon, leader of the opposition, released his own statement saying that we wouldn't have to worry about changes to abortion law in New Zealand under a national government. What do these responses say to you? What do they mean? Let's start with national.
It's multifaceted. Christopher Luxon is a person who, he said himself, he holds pro-life views and he sees abortion as tantamount to murder. That's number one. Number two is we've just watched three Supreme Court justices in the United States say Roe versus Wade is the law of the land, it's settled law, it won't be touched, lying through their teeth, basically, to get selected and on the court. So it makes us at Orans a bit skeptical when we hear these promises from Luxon that he's not going to touch abortion laws. The second thing I would say is that it's not simply a matter of overturning the abortion law or not, because even though a private member's bill could do that, there's lots of things, if Christopher Luxon was the Prime Minister, he could do that don't require parliamentary approval. So things I'm thinking of are safe areas. Safe areas passed last year or earlier this year, which allows the Minister for Health to implement a custom area around abortion clinics where protesters can't go because protesters were threatening patients and providers. That relies on the approval of the Minister of Health, an executive role. The Minister of Health could just refuse to implement safe areas. Things like funding to abortion services, part of the government's budget, largely separate from Parliament. Things like during COVID, they allowed access to tele-abortion. So you could have the pills for a medical abortion shipped to your home, so you didn't have to drive into the clinic and take it there, which made abortion more accessible. Things like that, that sort of innovation and responding to new circumstances, is not going to be supported by a government that doesn't value access to reproductive justice. So while it's great that we're, you know, holding his feet to the fire on his promise not to outright overturn it, our scrutiny of him should not end there. The third thing that I would say is that it's frustrating, I think, to see the leading voices of the National Party in this conversation being the ones that are anti-choice. You've got some great advocates for abortion rights. I'm thinking of Nicola Willis, and her voice has been really missing from this conversation. And we'd really like to see more of her standing up for women and people that can get pregnant rather than just those more anti-choice wings of the party. And I think we worry that if those views are allowed to kind of fester, that there is scope there for those sorts of changes that I've just warned about happening. And that's really, really concerning.
So what do you think should happen from Labor and our current government? Do you think that the response from ministers and the Prime Minister has been sufficient? What more do you think could be done or should be done?
It's really, I mean, in terms of the state, you know, they're a sovereign nation allowed to make their own laws. In terms of New Zealand, it's really keeping that commitment to access to reproductive justice. So it's ensuring those clinics are well funded, it's ensuring that when applications for safe areas do go through to a minister, they are approved and that they're appropriate. It's being transparent about new kind of technology in the space. So there's lots of things that it's not as simple as, oh, look, we decriminalised abortion. You've got to stay on top of this. One in four women have an abortion throughout their lifetime. It's a service relied on by a large percentage of the population. Beyond people that get pregnant, it's cliched, it takes two to make a baby. Abortions affect both the people having them and the people in their lives. So it is contrary to Chris Luxon's view. I mean, I think he said today, women don't care about abortion. They care about the cost of living. No, women do care about abortion. So we've got to keep our eye on the ball and make sure that we don't just relax in the idea that it could never happen here, or look, we legalized it last year or 2 years ago, I should say. We've done a great job. No need for any more scrutiny.
Do you have any predictions for the 2023 election, just regarding how the overturn of Roe v. Wade may be used politically, with political rhetoric and campaigning leading up to it? Do you see it being a factor, or both on the left and the right?
I mean, in New Zealand, to be blunt, Chris Luxon's issued about six statements already. He's kind of digging himself into a further hole. So, I mean, he is kind of making it an issue in New Zealand. And I think until we get a really clear, satisfactory, you know, answer or assurance about what's going to happen, it will have to be an issue. He's Luxon saying that it's not a New Zealand problem, it's an American problem, but that's just not true. Like it or not, America is a cultural beacon for most of the Western world, and we look to them. So their issues do become our issues. A lot of rhetoric is imported from the States. So I think if we've got a opposition party going down this path that have got some of their MPs celebrating it publicly online, it is going to have to become an issue because it's so crucial to women's bodily autonomy and sense of self and economic and social liberation. So, you know, as much as it would be great if we could be separate, we're not. Mm. And while we've still got a party that's really cause for concern about access to these services, it's going to have to be brought up and it's going to have to become an issue.
Now, I'll let you go soon, but I'd like to quickly talk about the Supreme Court in New Zealand's decision on Tuesday to deny Family First its charitable status, saying that its purposes are discriminatory and it advocates for measures to prefer the traditional family to the disadvantage of others, the quote-unquote traditional family being a man and a woman. How do you interpret this decision to deny it its charitable status? Do you think people could see it as a win or an assurance that we may not see the same backward slide in terms of rights in Aotearoa?
I mean, it's tricky. The first part of me wants to say, I don't know how much cultural capital Family First has, but I think that complacency is worrying. So yes, you've got to take it seriously that it's that kind of underbelly of New Zealand conservatism. We followed the Court of Appeal decision, which I think was end of 2020, quite closely, and Family First won and kept their charitable status. And we were really pleased to see that the Attorney General pushed ahead with this and appealed, because I think that shows a commitment to human rights and those values that Family First is so opposed to. So, I mean, the main implication for Family First will be they've lost their tax-free status as a charity and they have to pay tax, which, I mean, can't say we're too sad about. So, yeah, I mean, we definitely take it as a win. There's not much more to say about that.
All right. Well, there's a lot of anger and hurt and fear being felt all over the world. What can someone in Aotearoa do to support people in the States and to channel these feelings into something that hopefully results in some positive change?
There's a few things you can do. In terms of the States, you can look up and donate to abortion action funds. So I'm thinking in those 13 states in particular where, because of trigger laws, abortion's already banned. So that is states Arkansas, Idaho, Kentucky, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, South Dakota, Texas, Oklahoma, Utah, Wyoming, and Tennessee. So people in those states will not be able to access abortion at all and will have to travel, which incidentally is is not a solution. So that's the number one thing you can do. In terms of New Zealand, remain vigilant. It may seem silly, but you know, reposting those articles on Facebook, retweeting those tweets, commenting on the Herald posts on Facebook, things like that, that are really putting the pressure on anti-choice politicians in New Zealand to let them know that their views are not representative of New Zealand and therefore not an electable strategy, and to make sure we have that transparency that journalists see as a story to keep talking about and keep pushing and trying to dig down and get those assurances. So those are the two big things. Donate to abortion action funds in the States and don't become complacent in Aotearoa.
You just heard a bit of political commentary.